Welcome, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm Paul Niefer, your host, and actually, I'm actually looking out at sunshine right now, but it is definitely a little cooler. We're supposed to get snow tonight, but today I'm welcoming in to the podcast Roger McOwen. Roger, where are you at these days? I think you spend either more time on the road or about the same amount of time on the road as I do.
Well, I'm actually in San Angelo, Texas, this afternoon getting ready to speak for the next 2 days for the Texas Society of CPAs, the San Angelo chapter.
Oh, and is San Angelo, is that down, is that south, or whereabouts in Texas is that? I just don't remember.
It's about 80 to 90 miles south of Abilene.
Okay. So it's more the western side of the state versus the eastern side. So,
That's right.
Actually, I was down in Lubbock last Monday speaking, or was it Monday or Tuesday? One of those days. You know, these days with COVID and everything else, the days tend to blend together. So, well, today we're going to really have what I call a crystal ball, sort of your crystal ball, my crystal ball on taxes, where they're at, taxes, where they're going to go. But I think before we get started with that, just for our listeners out there, share a little bit of your background, where you were raised. I know you have a farming background and so on, but give us a, you know, about a 5 minute discussion on your background.
Well, I'm the youngest of six, and there's quite an age spread. There's a 25-year age spread with a 12-year gap between number five and me. So many people would say I'm an only child, but I grew up on a small farming operation in northeastern Indiana. My dad had bought the original acreage back in the early 1950s. I think it was 1951 or 52. And one of my brothers has another quarter that's not adjacent to it. It's across a section line. But that land is all rented out now. And it was just bare ground when my father bought it. But he dug ponds and planted trees. He liked to hunt and fish, and then farmed the land that he didn't put into water or trees. And then they had cattle and horses and hogs and chickens. And, you know, it was a well-diversified small farming operation, kind of typical of what you would find in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. Yep. And then by the time my father died in the late 1970s, and then the livestock went at that. And what I got in on the tail end of things was the raising of pheasants and quail in big field pens. And that was enjoyable. I really liked that. And my brother that still lives on the farm raises what's called African chuckers. They're basically, we would call them partridges. They're beautiful yep. birds. But he raises those, and then they release them in the fall. But so we're still into some little bit of wild bird production there, but not like it was when I grew up.
Yeah, I know my dad used to hunt pheasants when I was a kid. I never really, you know, got into it. I've hunted pheasant a couple times, but you know, even though they're a pretty good sized bird, they're still hard to hit. I mean, you know, they're a little craftier than we expect them to be at times. So
yeah, the first time I went hunting with my father was in World War II, and he was he always liked to hunt and fish. In fact, the story with my wife, I met her in Iowa when I moved out there to go to law school and graduate school. And it turns out that my father had hunted on her grandfather's farm back in Indiana, and they were close friends. And of course, I had no idea that was the case until after Gene and I met. But I remember one of the first times I went hunting with my father, he had bought me a new shotgun. It was a 410. And he was a real marksman. He had a Browning 22 rifle with a scope on it. And first time we went hunting, a quail went up, and he nailed that quail in flight with a scope with a 22 rifle. It's just, you can't compete with that.
No. I'd be lucky to hit, as the saying says, the broadside of a barn. So, yeah. So you grew up there. Where did you end up going to college then?
I went to Purdue, about 2.5 hours to the west, southwest of where I grew up. And when I went there, it was the early to mid 1980s. And it was kind of the height of the farm debt crisis in the 1980s. And that's really what got me interested in these legal issues and tax issues that farmers were finding themselves with, and bankruptcy issues, because it was all over the news. I mean, you could turn on the nightly news and the stories were coming out of Iowa in particular as to how bad things were. And it intrigued me that, you know, if you learn what these rules are, you can really provide some service to farm and ranch families to help them stay on the farm. But that really caught my attention. It was the farm debt crisis in the 80s. And I had a professor at Purdue that encouraged me to sit for the law school entrance exam. I did really well on that, had multiple offers to go various places, and did my first year at Indiana, down in Bloomington, southern Indiana, and then transferred out to Iowa to finish law school and go to graduate school.
Okay. And then, so that would have been out at, I'm assuming, Iowa State then?
Yeah, Iowa State was graduate school. Drake was law school.
Okay. And then I think you then actually started, did you start in rural Nebraska or go through that a little bit?
Yeah, I did. I started in North Platte, Nebraska. At that time, Don Kelly, who I just learned a couple of weeks ago, recently passed away. Don Kelly, the Kelly, Skritzmeyer and Byrne firm out in North Platte, was the lead firm in the country in terms of representing farmers and ranchers in estate planning, tax disputes, not so much the broad range of legal issues involving them, but if you want to get into entity planning, estate planning, income tax planning, that was the firm to work for. And I had actually started on the speaking circuit when I was a second year law student, and Don and one of the other partners had come up to Minneapolis to a meeting I was speaking at, and offered me a chance to come out and see North Platte and interview with them, and I did, and that's where I ended up starting.
Okay. And I've been to North Platte, I think, a couple times. I like that part of Nebraska. Of course, you know, my background, I'm definitely a farm boy at heart. So I'd much rather be out in the country than in the city most of the time. So well, now go ahead.
We would have clients that would drive 4 to 5 hours from way up in the Northwest Sandhills to come to town to shop, and they do their legal and their tax work while they're in town. And we work pretty closely with the CPA firms in town too. And so it was kind of a total package when the ranchers would come to town.
Yeah. Well, let's fast forward to what are you doing right now?
Well, I've got a number of oars in the water. I'm a law professor at Washburn Law School in Topeka, Kansas. I also teach over at K-State, Kansas State University in Manhattan, which is about an hour back to the west from Topeka, and also having to do some work for Extension there, and work with the Kansas Ag Mediation Service for them too. So I have those roles, and then that takes up about two-thirds of my contracted time, and then a third of it I reserve for my own stuff that I do in terms of speaking and traveling across the country. And this past May, I started a daily national radio program that's heard on about 135 stations coast to coast and on Sirius XM. So just a two-minute deal, a legal or tax issue each day. And so that keeps me busy too.
Yep. You got to come up with at least 2 minutes of material every day. That's, when you sign up for something like that, it sounds great, but then you also have to follow through on it too.
That's right.
Yeah. Speaking of that, it's like tomorrow at, it's 7 a.m. my time, 9 p.m. or 9 a.m. Central time. I have my little 2 to 5 minute segment on RFD TV, and I think you have a segment there too. So
I did that yesterday.
Yeah, we're used to that. So I think for the rest of the podcast, Roger, we're going to go through, we'll sort of touch briefly on maybe some of the major proposals that President Biden was proposing, but never really got through. Then we'll jump into the Build Back Better Act, which is now over in the Senate. And we'll just sort of some of this stuff we know likely will happen, but some of it that won't happen now, we'll sort of discuss, do we think it might happen in the future? You know, the one thing that certainly has probably, I won't say given me angst, but, you know, so much in the media, we had this description of we're going to eliminate, or they were going to eliminate step up and bases. But really, there was never a proposal to eliminate step up and bases. The proposal was we're going to have a transfer tax to keep step up and bases. So just give me, you know, a few minutes, your thoughts on that proposal and what was happening and so on and so forth.
Well, you're right. It wasn't just a clean repeal of the current step up and basis rule. And of course, what we're talking about there is there's a code section that says, in essence, that to the extent property is included in a decedent's estate at death, to that extent, you get a step up in basis equal to or step down, but you get a fair market value basis at the time of death. And that's pretty important to farmers and ranchers. And when they hear stories in the media or on radio or farm radio, farm TV, that Congress is going to remove step up and basis, it causes mass panic across the sector because that is so important to farm families. But you're right, it wasn't a wholesale proposal to repeal it. It was a modification of it, more along the lines as to what Canada does. And the way that they put basically $1 million in there that said, all right, you get a step up on the first million, and then you get some modifications as you go beyond that. But it wasn't a complete repeal of basis step up. Now, with that much said, it would have been bad enough to change from the current rule. And just thinking from an accounting standpoint and a record keeping standpoint, it would have presented additional problems for practitioners in trying to track basis. The current system that we have is very helpful because we get to start over when somebody dies and the property goes through the estate. And it's pretty easy to determine what the gain would be on subsequent sale by an heir because we get a clean basis to start over with again. So anytime you modify that, whether it's a wholesale change or not, does cause concern, and it causes concern in the practitioner community. And you know, it reminds me, this is mostly historical from my perspective, because I was pretty young. I wasn't into this in the late 1970s when, during the Carter administration, the Congress did change the rule, and they modified the carryover basis rule, and it didn't take them long to figure out that that wasn't going to work. It was the practitioner community that really objected to it, and so that got repealed on a retroactive basis along about 77, 78. So they had tried it before, and backed off from it. And again, they didn't do it this time either.
Yeah, it didn't work out very well back then. It probably wouldn't work out very well this time either. Now, the House originally, you know, they didn't really have a proposal on necessarily that side, but they did have one for farmers out there where Section 2032A, they were actually going to multiply it, and they were going to make it 10 times higher, which on the face of it sounds like a great deal. But in that case, you wouldn't get step up in basis. So what were your thoughts on the proposals on the 2032A section of the original House bill?
Yeah, what they were talking about there is the current provision. When you 2032A is special use valuation, and that allows a decedent's estate to value farm or ranch land in the estate at its value for ag purposes rather than fair market value. So if you're running up against the exemption equivalent of the unified credit, and it looks like you might be in excess of that, well, if you make a special use valuation election on the estate tax return, then you can drop out about $1.2 million worth of value and save the tax on that $1.2 million. So if we're looking at a 40% rate, you're saving somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000 worth of tax. Now, the proposal was to take that $1.2 million in value reduction maximum amount and increase it substantially. And then one of them, they started out running it up to $3 or $3.5 million. And then I think they said, well, we'll just allow a full reduction, basically up to $12 million. Yeah, there was a trade-off for that, and it was the basis trade-off, but none of that came to fruition either. That all got cut from the House version before the House passed it.
Yeah, and again, on the estate side, you know, there was a lot of discussion by Biden and some of the other senators, I'm going to say, to reduce that lifetime exemption next year. We know as of January 1st, it's $12,060,000, so let's round it to $12 million. That they're going to drop it down to $6 million instead of being in 2025, it would be next year. But again, that wasn't part of the House. Do you think? I guess now I'm having your crystal ball, my crystal ball. Let's say likely the House is going to go Republican next year, so really it's going to be sort of not much is going to happen. But when we come up to 2026. Do you really think the exemption is going to go down, or you think they're going to try to make it permanent?
Well, historically, it's never gone down.
I know.
Except for the one quirky year that was 2010. I don't know if you count that year or not, but it's really never gone down. And this is a question that I had lots of farm and ranch families ask me over the past year, because they're all worried about this, particularly farm wives that would call me concerned about losing the farm business if the basis rule changes and the exemption would come way down, particularly to $3.5 million, but even at $6 million. It's pretty easy for a farming operation in Kansas or Iowa or anywhere in the Midwest or the Plain States, given the current size of them, to exceed those levels. And I would tell people that, you know, based on history, they never reduce it. I'm not sure that was terribly reassuring to them, but you know, you would try to look at their plan that they had in place, see if there's some things that could be touched up, maintain whatever flexibility you can to kind of roll with what Congress might do. But then it was my belief that they talk about this all the time. We've been down this road multiple times before. They never do anything. And Paul, I just don't think they will going out into the future either.
I'm right there with you. I mean, I think, you know, we think it was going to happen. Well, even the House bill didn't even have an original proposal to reduce it. So right. I think we got to also remember a lot of these House members and Senate members, they're wealthy people. You know, this affects their pocketbook too. So I think we sometimes forget that a lot of them are having, you know, an estate greater than, you know, $12 or $20 million. So they definitely would be affected. And then, you know, continuing that train of thought, you know, there was a proposal by both Biden and by the House originally. I think it was in the House, but at least by Biden, that we're going to eliminate discounts on either investment assets inside of an LLC and corporation. But the latest bill that's floating around right now doesn't have that. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, that I think we really caught a big break on in terms of what the House passed. There was, that bill could have been so much worse for agriculture in general as it came out of the House, but they dropped so many things out of it that it's really not that big of a deal for our farm and ranch clients. And they did drop out the discounting rules, because that would have anytime you've got family related ownership, basically what they're going to take, what they propose to take away were valuation discounts. What we're talking about there are minority interest discounts, lack of marketability discounts, which is a big planning tool. That's another way to reduce taxable value in an estate. And we can use those discounts when we gift minority interests in a closely held farming or ranching entity during life, or set it up such that at death we're passing minority interest to heirs and carrying out a discount as it goes from one generation to the next. So it's a great tool to minimize taxable value, and the thought was that they would take some of that tool away, and they didn't take any of it away.
Yeah, and I actually thought you know, that that would probably happen, but as you said, it didn't happen at all.
Yeah. So, no, we caught a big break on what came out of the House. It's almost stunning to me what didn't get included in the House bill. And I think there's zero chance the Senate would add this stuff back in.
Yeah, and actually, you know, Wyden's, the Senate Finance Committee last Friday sort of came out with their proposal and, you know, almost mirror image. I mean, they really didn't make much changes to the House proposal at all. There's a few minor tweaks and so on, and a couple other things we'll talk about here a little bit later. And then finally, again, on the estate side, you know, there was a lot of angst in the farm community and the non-farm community about these changes that they were proposing on grantor trusts, you know, as far as restricting them or even eliminating the ability to use them. What's your thoughts on what was trying to be, what they were trying to accomplish there?
Well, I'm not sure what they were trying to accomplish. What would have happened was by making contributions to and or distributions from certain types of grantor trust in certain situations, they would have removed some very important planning tools off the table. Our grantor retained annuity trust, our intentionally defective trust. Those are nice estate planning tools, again, usually used by the wealthier client, but given the way the rules were set up, those techniques would have been removed from our toolbox, from our estate planning toolbox. So I'm glad those rules didn't make it in. Those were really tricky. When you dug into the statutory provisions on the grantor trust rules, it raised a lot of questions in terms of what does certain language that's currently in a trust mean? How do we know if the trust property will be ultimately included in a decedent's estate? If it's in the estate, then the transfer to it up front's not a taxable event, and vice versa. Well, a lot of that depends on the language in the trust instrument, and what if the trust instrument is changed after it's created? I just think it wouldn't have been workable the way that it was drafted. I think that would have been horrible. So I'm glad that that got pulled.
Yeah. Same here. I mean, it's like they throw things out there. If it sticks, then they go with it. But like you said, really what finally got in the Build Back Better Act, for at least for most of my ag clients, and I think the clients that you deal with, really is pretty innocuous for most of our farmers out there.
Yeah, it is. We caught a big break. This could have been so much worse coming out of the House than it actually was. So we got a big break.
Yeah. Okay. Right now, Roger, we're going to go ahead and take a break for a sponsor message, and then we'll come back and discuss some of the items that are actually in the bill and a couple other things. So we'll go ahead and take a quick break right now.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm Paul Niefer, your host, and we're joined again by Roger McGowan from Washburn University, and we're sort of reviewing some of the items that are in the Build Back Better Act, at least as it's currently sitting over in the Senate. The one area, Roger, that I thought maybe they'd get some traction on was that they were going to raise the corporate tax rate. Now, Biden wanted to bump it up to 28%. The House said 26.5%. But what I liked about the House proposal, the original proposal, was the first $400,000 of income at a corporate level would be taxed at 18%, which would be a reduction from the 21%. But that got nixed. You know, we can, I guess, give credit or blame Senator Sinema from Arizona for that. But what were your thoughts on the corporate provisions that they were talking about?
Well, again, another surprise there. I thought that one was probably a done deal. Now what they did, and I think it's still in there, correct me if I'm wrong, they did bring back the corporate AMT. So the AMT is brought back, but they kept the rate at the 21% flat rate for corporations. So it doesn't really change for the vast majority of farm clients. It's not going to change the way we evaluate entity structure in terms of what's an appropriate entity structure for a farm client. We still are operating with the same rules. So I was surprised by it. I thought the corporate rate would go up, but they didn't do that either.
And then the one thing that if they ever did pass this, you know, some inquiring mind would find out what large Democratic donor created an S corporation as of May 13th, 1996, because there was a provision that if you had an S corp as of that date, didn't have to be created on that date, but you had it as of that date, and it had always been an S corp, they're going to give you this 2-year period, 2022 and 2023, to liquidate the corporation tax free, which I would have been all over that. I mean, I think you and I both would have been all over that. But again, that didn't make it into the final bill. So, so there were some proposals that the House had that are actually good. The problem is they didn't get into the bill.
Right. Yeah, I wonder about that May provision back in the 90s. When I saw that, I had the same reaction probably you did, and that is, all right, who did what back then that is writing policy? Because we see that happen over the years. That's happened numerous times in the Congress. You get a special provision because somebody creates it for themselves. Or for a significant constituent. And I haven't been able to track that one down, where that one came from. But you're probably right. It is tied to something that somebody did somewhere that's important or is writing policy.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, if they'd said it was as of January 1st of 1996, you know, people might have said, oh, okay, no big deal. But May 13th, you know, there's something special about that date. So, then... Also, there was a lot of talk by both President Biden and the House originally that they were going to raise both the individual income tax rate back up to the 39.6. And then Biden wanted to raise the capital gain rate back up to 39.6 over a million. But the House would only bump it up to 25%. But again, that didn't get into the bill at all. What's your thoughts on... Do you think down the road we might be seeing some increases in those rates, or where do you think we're at over the next few years?
Well, if they keep spending trillions upon trillions of dollars, that's what we're faced with, or an increase in tax rates. They got to raise revenue somehow to pay for this stuff. And so that does trouble me from a long run standpoint. And the money supply, M1, is just out of control right now. So unless the Fed takes action like a Paul Volcker back in the late 1970s to get inflation under control, we got major problems. And they can't choke off the economy, because doing so will dramatically decrease revenue. So they've got a fine line they have to play. You can't increase rates too much. You got to get the economy rolling so you can raise the revenue. But I guess it depends on whether you're a Keynesian or whether you're a Friedman disciple.
Yeah. Or whether you're a Bernie Sanders disciple.
Or Bernie Sanders,
Or Elizabeth Warren, you know, one of those. So, well, we've sort of talked about what didn't get into the bill. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about what is in the bill. And in my opinion, is likely to stay in the bill. That's even assuming that this bill passed, and we'll talk about that here in a second. So the first thing I think that might affect some of our farmers is the net investment income tax, the expansion as far as the type of income. Go over those details.
Yeah, the NIIT is that additional 3.8% tax that was created, started in 2013 under Obamacare, on passive sources of income. And what this proposal would do is expand that to active trader business income once you're up above a certain threshold. And if I remember right, it's 400,000 single, 500,000 married filing joint. that would create some issues for us. So it's never applied to active trader business income. It's always been kind of a passive tax on that. So for those clients up above those thresholds, we would have to watch that. That one bothers me. I would prefer that they would drop that one out.
I don't think they're going to. It raises way too much money, and it's easy to claim it only affects the quote rich. And right. And again, for farmers, they need to understand this isn't on taxable income. This is on your AGI, and it's right. before any itemized deductions, and it's before any of that Section 199A deduction. And for a lot of farmers, they end up with taxable income of a couple hundred thousand dollars, but they have this huge DPAD flowing through from the cooperative to get them down. They're now going to be hit with maybe, I'm thinking of some of our farmers that I know I deal with, they're going to be hit with an extra $30,000 to $60,000 of tax, and there's not a whole lot that they can do about it. So that's what plus it's non-deductible, you know, the Medicare tax is deductible. This or half of it is, this is not. So
this 3.8% tax, they've had a number of opportunities over the last 5 or 6 years to get rid of this. You know, when TCJA was being debated, and before that went into effect starting in 2018, there was a legitimate opportunity to just take it out. And I think you and I were in we were in Wyoming doing a summer event in Wyoming, and I think the word came across while we were there. In northern Wyoming speaking, the name of the town escapes me, where we were at. We were at a college there.
Sheridan. Yeah.
And the news came across the tax services that the 1411 tax was not going to be removed. And if they couldn't remove it when the Republicans were in control, that thing is probably cemented into the tax code.
Well, it's sort of an easy way to raise revenues, because you're not changing the tax rate. This is just an extra tax on that stuff. But farmers need to understand that means all of their S corporation income, all of their partnership income, all of their commodity wage income, all of their self rental income. Mm-hmm. You're either paying the 3.8% net investment income tax, or you're paying the 3.8% self employment tax. Now, again, this is only if your income's above a certain level. So if your income's under that 400,000 range, don't worry about it. But for a lot of farmers, they're above that, and then their taxable income comes down. So that's the net investment income tax. Another one that I think is going to bite more of our farmers than they realize is this changes on the excess business loss. Go through those details.
Well, the EBL rules changed with TCJA, and now they're proposing to change them again. Eliminate the benefit that we've had with respect to excess business losses, where if you've got a major excess business loss and you can use cash accounting, then you could take any excess and it would be treated as your net operating loss. Well, they're changing those rules around, so it effectively would increase your effective tax rate. That would bite, as you said, some of the farmers that are out there. If you've got major losses, the way they're changing that is going to increase your effective rate.
Yeah, especially the fact now this isn't because of the BBB, it's because of the CARES Act or the CAA, but they no longer allow you to offset business losses against wage income. So a lot of our farmers out there, they have a fairly large amount of wage income, and they also have a farm loss that historically, at least until last or this year, they could always offset it against the wage income. Well, that's no longer true. So, this is going to start. And again, this raises over a 10-year period. I think it raises about $200 billion. So that's a fairly large large increase. And then we know that the House also had some changes on the state and local tax deduction or the SALT deduction. Go through that, and then we'll see what's happening in the Senate a little bit.
Well, this one's interesting, and I think this one probably will stick. Of course, TCJA put a limitation on the state and local tax deductibility and capped it at $10,000. Well, if you're in a high tax state, such as California, Illinois, New York, some of those deep blue states. That has created a lot of pushback from people there, and the politicians have heard that. So they came up with a proposal to bump that up to $80,000 for a few years and then take the $80,000 limit off, go unlimited, and then, you know, about 10 years out from now, put it back at $10,000 and then take that limit off. So it's basically a tax cut followed by a tax increase, followed by a tax cut, followed by a tax increase for the next 10, 12 years. Because keep in mind, under TCJA, the $10,000 cap comes off after 2025, and right. then you're unlimited starting in 2026. This would have that $80,000 on there, and so starting in 2026, it would be a tax increase compared to where we're at right now. Because the limit would come off starting in 26 if they do nothing. But I think they probably will change that, and they'll increase it currently to 80,000, and then they'll probably mess with it again out into the future.
Well, I think over in the Senate, we keep hearing, you know, there's a little bit of battle between Senator Sanders of Vermont and Senator Menendez of New Jersey. You know, Bernie's saying, hey, nobody gets any benefit if their income's over 400 grand. Whereas yeah. Menendez, because he's from New Jersey, he wants to have it maybe up at $1 million. So there's going to be some changes, but there's definitely going to be something to increase that $10,000 cap. And that is retroactive to the beginning of this year. So, you know, for 2021 tax returns, you may be able to deduct quite a bit more on the state income tax side. And also the excess business loss changes mm-hmm. are also retroactive to this year. So we'll see what happens there. Those are some of the key things. You know, there's a bunch of little, well, not necessarily little stuff, but other stuff that probably really doesn't apply on the farm side. I guess right now, let's crystal ball wise, do you think this thing's going to pass?
That's it really comes down to Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema. And I know they wanted to see, particularly Manchin, he wanted to see the CBO score of the bill, and that score came back that it was going to increase deficit spending tremendously. And then the administration trots out their spokesperson and said, well, that's a false report. So it's kind of interesting what's happening. But Manchin and Sinema really hold the cards. Manchin doesn't like the spending. He doesn't like all the energy related provisions that are going to hurt coal in his state. That's important to him and coal production, or increase the cost of that. So that's they got to have his vote. Sinema doesn't like tax increases. So there's an interesting dichotomy there between those two, one not wanting to increase taxes, the other one not wanting to increase spending. And they've got to hold all 50 Democrats in the Senate, or this doesn't go anywhere. So I think if they're going to try to get this done by Christmas or definitely by the end of the year, they're going to have to do some serious horse trading probably to get those two. So if it doesn't happen, I don't think anything happens in 2022.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I know Manchin's supposed to meet with Biden on Friday. Well, if they're just having a meeting on Friday, that, you know, the chance of this happening by Christmas is the same as the Jacksonville Jaguars winning the Super Bowl this year, I think. I think there's no chance, so we'll see what happens. But, you know, do you think, you know, with the idea that, likely, as we said, the House next year is going to change to Republican. There's even a very good chance that the Senate will change to Republican. At that point, do we basically have a lame duck president and nothing really on the tax side is going to happen?
Well, some of us might say that we currently have a lame duck president anyway. So, I think that's the case. When your poll numbers are in the tank, That makes it, he loses a lot of political capital. He's not one that's going to be able to go and strong arm people in the Senate to side with him when his poll numbers are terrible. So there's no, he can't put pressure on him that way from a political standpoint. He has to sell it based on the credibility of the provisions in the bill itself. That's a tough sell, and particularly to those two on the Democrat side, Manchin and Sinema. So again, if this doesn't get done by the end of this year, I just can't see this happening in 2022 because you're rolling into a political season already. And, you know, unless they've made the calculus that, you know, things are bad enough on the Democratic side from a political standpoint that they're going to lose anyway. And so they just discount all that and push the bill through. I guess that's a possibility, too.
But I think we've already said it a little bit, and I'm going to echo what you said, that really, as the BBB is right now, as the Build Back Better Act is, really for most of our clients in agriculture, there really is not much pain that's going to result. Would you agree with that?
As of right now, yeah, I agree with that. I mean, what came out of the House is pretty good compared to what it could have been.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the original proposal that the House had wasn't great. Certainly the proposal that President Biden had in the Green Book was not really good at all. Of course, we got to remember, if we go back to President Obama, a lot of what was in President Biden's Green Book was also in President Obama's Green Book, and it never happened. So, right. You know, a lot of times these are just sort of the wish list, and then dealing with the fact that you're dealing with a very divided Congress right now, well, a very divided American public, really, it's just going to be difficult to make major, major changes.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's a good thing. I don't think that's a good thing at all.
Yeah. Well, this has been a very, for two tax nerds like you and I, this has been pretty interesting. Hopefully for the listeners out there, it's been pretty interesting. Anything else that you want to share with the listeners right now before we end the podcast?
Well, I just hope everyone has a really enjoyable Christmas and gets to spend time with their families. I would say, you know, from an economic standpoint, we're going to have issues in agriculture with our input costs. I'm finding here in the Midwest and talking with farmers that they're not able to prepay their inputs for next spring to the extent they would like, just because of supply shortages and so forth. So that brings up other tax issues. I mean, what, you know, if you're used to doing that and now you can't do that, maybe you need to look at some other things, perhaps farm income averaging, smooth that income down to try to deal with the inability to prepay the extent you'd like to prepay. But I think that's a problem everywhere. Fertilizer costs way up, your seed costs way up. That's a problem. I can't frankly remember a year where we've had this dramatic price rise in input costs as we're seeing right now.
No, and or the lack of supply. I mean, I think we've had rapid increases in some inputs, but not rapid increases plus a lack of supply.
Right.
And then because of that also, you know, a lot of farmers would then say, hey, I can go out and buy a new combine or a new tractor. Well, you can't buy a new combine or a new tractor right now and get it delivered this year. It's going to be in 2022, or I've already heard it's in 2023.
Yeah.
So, I've heard that. So, you know, you're not going to be able to buy that new tractor. Now, you could buy a used piece of equipment, but that price is up 30% also. So, yeah, you're right. I think this is a year where maybe some farmers are going to end up biting the bullet and paying more tax than they're used to. But my saying that I've always had is, remember, working capital that you've paid tax on is your working capital. If you haven't paid tax on it, it's either Uncle Sam or it's the bank. So, you know, sometimes paying tax on that working capital is a good thing, not a bad thing. So,
That's hard to, that's a hard point to get across to some farmers too.
Yep. Well, again, Roger, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come on for the podcast here. And probably after the BBB is passed, I'll probably maybe have another podcast with you.
Oh, that'd be great, Paul. Thanks for having me as your guest. I appreciate it.
Again, this is the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. This is Paul Niefer, your host, signing off.